This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Booz Allen Hamilton Expert Voices panel, Cyber 2020, the future of the Internet. Pressing challenges around issues like cybersecurity, net neutrality, and internet governance have one thing in common. They all exist in cyberspace. Cyberspace is more than just a technology. It is a domain, similar to the domains of land, air, space, and the sea, with national and international dimensions. In today's discussion, Cyber 2020, the future of the Internet, we will discuss how the U.S. can shape global cyber landscape, or the global cyber landscape, to promote and protect its economic, social, and security interests in cyberspace while ensuring the openness of the Internet and ensuring the privacy of the individuals. In my view, this is a balancing challenge worthy of a digital age Madison, Jefferson, and Adams to resolve. I'd like to now introduce our distinguished panelists for today's discussion. First, to my immediate left, Brigadier General John Davis. John is the current Director of Operations, known as the J-33, for U.S. Cyber Command for the Department of Defense. This is the man charged with carrying out the Department of Defense missions in a cyber war. Next, Dr. Bob Kahn, Chairman and CEO and President of the Corporation for National Research Initiatives, better known, along with Vint Cerf, as the co-inventor of the Internet when they created the TCP/IP protocols. Next in our panel is Dr. Jim Lewis, Senior Fellow, Center for Strategic and International Studies. He is a leading authority on cyberspace issues and was the lead author for the document describing cybersecurity issues for the current president. Next in our list is retired Colonel and also Dr. Greg Rattray. He's a partner in Delta Risk, former colonel in the United States Air Force, where he commanded the Air Force Information Warfare Center. He also served in the White House as the official responsible for security in cyberspace. And finally in our panel is Daniel Weitzner, Associate Administrator for the Office of Policy Analysis and Development, the National Telecommunications and Information Association, better known as NTIA, of the Department of Commerce. And this is where many of the Internet policy decisions are currently being made. I'd like to start with an opening question. A well-articulated characterization of cyberspace is key to building consensus around cybersecurity, economic, and policy decisions. How can policymakers move beyond a fragmented definition of cyberspace to embrace convergence and confront the domain's security, cultural, economic, and political realities? The way I'm framing this question is the governance for cyberspace and the institutions that provide governance go back over 100 years. So as we consider a technology that's changed literally the nation in less than a generation, how do policymakers think about this now to govern the process going forward? I'd like to open it first to Dr. Kahn.
Well, the first question I would like to put on the table with regard to the question of sort of cyberspace and governance is the question of what do we mean by cyberspace in the first place? And I think in today's context, we're really talking about the Internet as the concrete example of what that word must intend to imply. I don't think it's possible to get a good definition of the term. It's more of a genre of activities. But today, I think we're fundamentally talking about the Internet. And I think the notion of what the Internet is not very well grounded in virtually any community. To me, it's all about the protocols and procedures that allow different components to work together. Mm-hmm. So the components are communication providers and their application service providers. They may be actual devices of one sort or another that provide services. And so when you have, you know, discussions like net neutrality, they were really not about the Internet, even though they were often claimed to be, because they weren't really challenging the protocols and procedures. They were really talking about policies that ought to apply to specific components of the internet, like a communication service provider. So I think one of our challenges is to really understand better what the internet is and how it applies in terms of both policies and laws.
What I would highlight is that Dr. Khan not only is co-inventor of the process that created the internet, he's also a PhD in EE and from Princeton and taught it at MIT. And what he just described, in my view, would be a challenge in talking with a policymaker about what does that policymaker need to do.
I think in a lot of ways what's critical from a policy perspective about the internet and the World Wide Web is the institutions that Bob and his colleague Vint Cerf and Tim Berners-Lee created that really have given life to this incredibly complex sort of spaghetti strap set of technologies and private companies and individuals who really make the internet work. And I think from a policy perspective, the key starting point for us is we've got to look at those institutions. They're unconventional institutions. The internet was not created by the Federal Communications Commission. Mm-hmm. It wasn't created by the International Telecommunications Union. It was created by upstarts like Bob, if I could say. And it's grown and continued by a voluntary global coming together of lots of different institutions that on a day-to-day basis are working all over the world to keep it functioning at every level. And I think, so from a policy perspective, our challenge as governments, the U.S. government, other governments around the world, is to understand how to work with those institutions that keep the internet vital and dynamic and stable and realize that in order to achieve critical public policy purposes that are government's responsibilities, security, stability, safety, freedom, we've got to learn how to work with those institutions.
Let me pull Greg Rattray into the discussion here. Greg, you served in the White House and struggled with many of these same issues, but when you look at, consider the fact we're a nation of laws and you look at authorities, in the context of the internet or the digital age, if you're exploiting it, that's a Title 50 authority over in the intelligence community. If you're attacking it, that's a Title 10 authority in DOD. And if you're defending it, that's a Title 6 authority in the Department of Homeland Security. So how do you cause that process to come together in a coordinated way to consider the policy that we have to generate going forward?
So to build on a couple of the threads we've already started, I do think you started the notion that cyberspace is a domain, right? I do think as we grapple with it across all those different sets of activities, intelligence, disruptive activities that we might conduct or be conducted to ourselves, we do need to go broader than the internet, right? I think the internet connotates, has a technical layer that Bob and others could define for us. It connotates, however, for people just a fairly limited set of activities. The use of wireless technologies, devices, may use the internet, may not. Organizations use cyberspace for a lot of things that intersect with the internet but go beyond it. So first, I think we've got to make sure we have a construct that allows us to look forward beyond just what people traditionally think of as the internet. I do like the notion of a domain, not disconnected from a physical reality. Cyberspace is made up of technologies that connect through the laws of physics in terms of, being an environment that we can shape. The interesting thing about the internet is it's a domain that's man-made, right? So unlike air and space, the physics that surround it, while electromagnetic physics need to be understood as a natural phenomena, the code that flows through it, the rules by which it's governed are something that governments can shape. In terms of how we coordinate in the U.S. government, I think we've done well in the last few years on this notion that it is a domain, that securing it, and ensuring public safety is a collaborative activity between, all the different organizations with the authorities that you mentioned.
Let me go to General Davis. How do you fight in cyberspace?
Well, I think that the military has learned some things over the past several years by operating in this domain that might be useful in shaping future policy. The military has defined cyberspace and cyberspace operations, and one of the key components in that definition is the interdependence between the information technology systems, the internet, telecommunications, satellite communications, computer systems, and then the hardware and software that connect it. We realize in defining, the military realizes in defining cyberspace and cyberspace operations so far, that this notion of interdependence means that it's a collaborative effort, has to be a collaborative effort. No one entity at the governmental level has enough capacity, resources, authorities, skill sets to operate effectively in this domain. I do think when you look at fighting in the cyberspace domain, one of the things that needs to be involved in the shaping of definition is an understanding of the threat. Mm-hmm. And I think that's critical. From a DoD perspective, we know we face a broad range of threats to our systems today. Patriotic hackers, criminal activities, terrorist organizations, and nation states. There are some 140 different nation states that are trying to get into our military systems. We're probed about 250,000 times an hour. These present real challenges for us in terms of balancing the ability to operate, because everything we do in the military, our traditional operational domains of land, maritime, air, and space, rely increasingly on cyberspace. So the threat has to be factored in. And then the final point I'd say about fighting in the cyber domain is I think we need to be cognizant of the fact that there are different layers to this. There's geography. Everything ends up on some point on the earth, and geography matters in making policy-level decisions. There are the logical layers, the networks and the devices, and then there are people at the other end of it. We have to have, I think our experience in the military in informing the way that policy evolves in the future is a broad understanding of all of those different layers and how they connect to one another.
This has been our turn to sort of define cyberspace. I'm going to go to two final comments, one from Danny and then from Bob Kahn. Danny, over to you first.
Please, I want to pick up on the point the General made that ultimately, whether we're calling it the internet or cyberspace or anything else, this is an arena that's defined by people at the endpoints, right? I mean, we've got a lot of physical, logical infrastructure underneath, but at the end of the day, we only care about it, whether for a defensive purpose, an offensive purpose, an economic purpose, a political purpose, because there are people involved. I would suggest to you that the only jurisdictional hook we ultimately have here to define this domain is where people are. Data flows around too quickly to define where it is. I'd suggest that it's really in our economic and social interest to be broad-minded about the location of data, to worry a little bit less, because the great efficiencies that we get from the internet, particularly with this current realm of cloud computing services where information can flow around, really depend on the ability to move information around very quickly. I don't think we want to be in the business, and I don't think you're suggesting that we get into the business of trying to control more tightly how information flows. But I think when we're talking about policy objectives, whether it's economic or social policy or defense policy, ultimately we're talking about harm or benefit to people who sit at the ends of these networks. And I think that's where our attention has to be.
One thing I would highlight is data has value. And some authors are starting to argue that computing becomes a utility, therefore cloud, therefore concentration of data. So that would have some impact on how we think about it. But I want to ask Dr. Kahn, you've probably done more thinking about this than anyone I know. What does cyberspace look like in 10 years?
Well, I guess the short answer is that nobody really knows. Just stick around and you'll get a better idea.
Let's hope we both last that long.
I wanted to start my comments by just closing on this notion of definitions, because it does affect how we think about things, mm-hmm. and how we talk about it. Greg made a comment before about, you know, maybe wireless devices connecting to the internet. The way I think about it, since the internet at a technical level is all about the protocols and procedures and not about the components, that the things that implement the protocols and procedures absolutely include the end devices, the computers, the applications, the services. Those are as important a part of the internet as any of the communication resources that are used to connect it. So the idea of a wireless device connecting to the internet is about as interesting to me as the communication networks connecting to the user devices. They're all part of the internet in some seamless way. And yet we often think about just the carrier net as being the internet and the like.
Let me return us to this focus on policy.
Okay.
This is, in my view, the hardest question. What U.S. policies are going to be most helpful in ensuring we do two things? Ensuring we achieve a level of security and protection. We have to protect data that's vital to the lifeblood of the country while maintaining its openness. How do you get openness and protection in the internet?
Well, I'll be happy to start, but
please, Dr. Khan.
And the specific answer to that question, I'm going to sort of not address head on because I think you'll hear more from the others, but let me tell you what I think the single most important thing that the government can do to ensure a healthy future for the internet at a policy level is to ensure that we not lock ourselves into the technology of the past. It's very easy to do that because you get a lot of major organizations that get committed to given ways of doing things. We certainly saw that with the carriers and circuit switching, and we had to get the research community to work around them to show them that packet switching was actually a better alternative, which they later adopted. But to the extent that we get locked into the technology of the past and don't allow the future to really happen, whether it's through research funding and just plain innovation, or it's policies that allow different alternatives to take place, we're going to be shortchanging the internet for the future.
So what you're arguing is while technology is a driver, innovation is important, it's the policy framework that's really, really important. Let me go to Greg and then we'll go to Danny. Greg,
so definitely building on that, I think, you know, Bob is stressing the internet is open because it's been a vibrant, dynamic environment for innovation. We can't predict where that's going to go. Mike, my perspective is if you recognize that and we fundamentally believe that's crucial, you're going to have to deal with an environment with a lot of risk, right? So that the policy really needs to be about risk management. I don't think there's a sword that cuts the Gordian knot and allows you to get both the vibrancy and the security, you know, and you're going to have to figure out how to utilize this vibrant environment. If you're the military, you may have much more constricted rules about, you know, who talks to whom and how you use the environment. And then you need to be resilient and agile. It's going to change fast. I think the policy really needs to focus on the human capital that can take advantage of it when you need it and then react when the bad things happen. It's not necessarily a policy that's about how you get an internet that is both secure and open at the same time.
Dan?
From an economic policy perspective, from a global policy perspective, we're at a really unique point where we're talking about these issues because the U.S. has an extraordinary leadership position in the technology and in the business environment that defines the internet. A disproportionate share of the innovation in the internet comes from both the infrastructure and the applications and the institutional ability to take advantage of it. A disproportionate share comes from the U.S. I think our greatest strength when it comes to securing the internet is to retain that innovative edge, because that means we're closest to the whatever the technology frontier is. It means we have the human capital to guide the internet in a direction that balances these issues. And you know, I think that it places huge responsibility really on the U.S. to frame a policy environment that can be globally scalable. To Jim's point, we are facing real divergence around the world. Countries who, I think, 10, 15 years ago looked at the internet and said, gee whiz, this is kind of a cool thing. Maybe we can get some of that. Now what they see is, very candidly, sometimes a U.S. export that is threatening both to their business environment, to their security environment, and to some of their social values. So it's up to the U.S. to really step up and take a leadership position and frame a global internet policy that strikes this kind of balances that you're talking about.
Let me ask a follow-on question. Is there a plethora of press articles about varying nation states taking intellectual property, innovative ideas out of our system? Some have described it as bleeding of our innovation engine. How do you think about that in the Department of Commerce and NTIA, about the fact that terabits of data are being taken from very literally every institution, whether it's government or or the Congress or the aerospace or software or wherever? How do you think about that?
You know, we have a dual set of challenges there. There's a huge challenge globally to make sure that U.S. intellectual property is protected both domestically and around the world. We're the source of a huge amount of that intellectual property, so we have a real interest in protecting that. That means developing innovative law enforcement strategies, and I think we're seeing tremendous progress also in cooperation between the different components of the internet that Bob referred to. Internet service providers are looking at how they can cooperate with the producers of intellectual property, of music, of videos, of movies, to make sure that people aren't using services in a way that perpetrate intellectual property theft. I think we're doing very well there. We need to do a lot more. We also need to recognize that, again, one of these balances, if we tighten up too much on the flow of information, we'll lose our position as the center of internet innovation, and it'll go elsewhere. So we've absolutely got to protect this as a critical U.S. export. Intellectual property accounts for tens of hundreds of billions of dollars of U.S. export, and we've got to make sure that we can protect that.
Jim Lewis, we're focused on the policy aspects of this, and I'd like to come to get your views on where we are in this dialogue.
Yeah, and I think we need to step back for a minute. So you asked about policy. Let's talk about three boxes. The first box is international engagement. We haven't done it. We need to do it for trade, law enforcement, security. The administration is thinking about it. That's good. I mean, that's a step over where they were in the past. But we really need to get out there because other countries are not going to wait for us anymore. And if you look at the Chinese or the Russians or the Brazilians, they have a different view. And if we sit back and assume that they're going to accede to our leadership without us actually leading, that's a mistake.
Second issue. Is this leading to international agreements?
International governments, trade issues. Yeah. You know, when have we ever complained to the Chinese about their IP pilfering? Well, we kind of complained about Google. We sent them a postcard that said we were unhappy. That's a good first step. Trade issues, law enforcement cooperation. The current cooperation of law enforcement is gridlocked. Right? We're not going to get any further with the models we have now. Security. Everyone's really afraid about Cyber Command. When you talk to other governments, the at least outside of NATO, the first thing they say is that the U.S. is the most frightening power in cyberspace. And that's good. I kind of enjoy it. But also, we have to deal with that. Internally, we have two sets of issues, right? We have to confront what is the role of government in some of these problems. And my view, after doing this for a while, is that if we expect critical infrastructure companies to ever protect themselves, we're making a mistake. And particularly as we move to managed services to the cloud, there's going to be more emphasis on getting the service providers to do the right thing. Doesn't mean heavy-handed regulation. Doesn't mean we want to go in and set up best practices, because frankly, the government doesn't know what they are. But we've got to find some way to incentivize or scare the domestic industries to do a better job.
So it's money or regulation. That's sort of your choice. Incentivize on the one hand or threaten.
And you know where we are now in regard to the money situation.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Finally, there is this research.
So the government, the point you're making is the government role is public safety and security, and
right.
You may have to regulate your way into a more secure regime.
The government isn't doing the best it could for its citizens, and that could be a competitive disadvantage over the long term. Finally, there's this research question, this innovation question, and that really gets us out of the cyber element. But when you think about, you know, a few years ago, maybe 10, 15 years ago, the U.S. decided they'd rather be mortgage bankers than engineers, and we might want to reconsider that decision. If we want to maintain that leadership in innovation and technology, might need to graduate a few more engineers.
Before we leave this subject to move on to our next, this set of panel members has thought more about this issue than most. And so looking out over the next 10 years, if we can project, what's the greatest opportunity and what's the greatest threat in the cyberspace arena?
The greatest threat is that other places will take the lead, right? And if you talk to, say, the Chinese, they'll tell you the internet is a core component of American economic and military hegemony, and we want to dismantle it. And I think other countries think the way they do. So if we don't come out with some acceptable new model for governance, we'll see somebody else take the ball away from us. And I think that's the biggest threat.
Greatest threat. Greg.
So on the threat, I basically concur with Jim. And
The example I use is to not be on cybersecurity where we were on the landmine treaty, where it's the U.S., you know, saying it won't accept a set of global principles that, you know, eventually the Chinese, the Russians, and the Brazilians have coalesced around. So I think the opportunity is, I think our thinking in terms of keeping the internet vibrant and the global interconnectivity does resonate with most people in the globe, if not even most governments. But we may not want to lead from the front. We need to figure out how to team with the Brazilians if there's the right opportunity in going to Latin America and convincing them about the principles that the internet needs to be governed by regionally and globally, and not necessarily always have to be at the front of the room when we're having that dialogue.
Danny.
I think that the greatest threat is the one that Jim alluded to, that individual countries will disrupt the free flow of information on the internet and reduce its value as a global marketplace and a global forum for the exchange of ideas and information. That is clearly our greatest threat, because countries, if you go and ask this question in other countries, they will tell you that the greatest threat is the very disruptive force that the internet is. For us, the greatest opportunity, I think, is to work with allies, in some cases at a nation-state level, but I'd suggest also at a kind of a business and civil society level as well. Our greatest opportunity is to help more and more of the world realize the potential of the internet, realize that they can be on this innovation path as well with us. We see evidence of that all over the world. There's not a country where you can't point to some piece of internet innovation happening at the application or services or infrastructure level. We've got to encourage that. And really, I think, recognize the generational split that we're facing, that this is not a problem of so much the U.S. versus China, just writ large. This is a problem of one generation of business and political and social thinking in China as against the internet revolution, which really is a global phenomenon, which has adherents everywhere around the world.
A thread through most of the comments leads back to there are threats and there are issues, but it's leadership. If we're going to maintain our role and continue to benefit from it, the United States is going to have to maintain its leadership position. So I want to shift now to our focus on governance of the process. And how would you do this? And so let me read a question for the panel. What are the key challenges the U.S. will face over the next decade in retaining a leadership role within the cyberspace domain? So challenges to the U.S. role as it plays out over the next 10 years. Who would like to take that on? Well, let me go Dr. Khan, and then we'll come to the general.
Well, actually, this links with your former question about the greatest threats.
There's a lot of linkage here, as you
So I want to point out sort of a technical one and a policy one. Let me just say, policy-wise, I think the thing we need to be most cognizant about is finding a way to deal with the latent feelings around the rest of the world that this is a U.S.-driven activity. The fact that, I mean, it's all been galvanized around ICANN historically because they thought that was the symbolism. And I've been very public in saying I think ICANN is really doing a good job, leave it alone. And there are things in parallel with it that can exist, and we should let a thousand flowers bloom. So at the policy level, I think it's trying to understand how to alleviate that pressure that comes from other countries and let them feel more like they're playing in a level playing field. At a technical level, I think we face an increasingly set of difficult challenges simply because of the fact that we have very difficult time understanding what's going on within the internet. I mean, this would be akin, in my view, to trying to deal with threats that come from the air when we have no good air traffic control system. We can't see what's up there. Right. Today, we are principally flying blind in cyberspace. That doesn't mean we can't see certain things. We can't hear there was a noise over there, something flew low over there. But there's no substructure in the internet today that will allow us to deal with what I consider to be the biggest threats that we're going to encounter in the future. And I think that will require some amount of leadership on the funding level, on the policy level, and working with businesses to try and restructure it around some notion that lets us understand how to better manage the information that's going on there. And that's where I think something like a digital object architecture can play a major role in the future.
It's interesting that you start with the premise of how the United States is perceived. I mean, we are the global power, and we prevailed in the Cold War, and it's literally how we're perceived around the globe. Let me go to the general, ask key challenges we'll face in maintaining leadership.
I think the biggest challenges that we'll face in the near future are balance, education, and building the workforce that we need to deal effectively in this arena. We've talked a lot about balance in the military. Dramatic change in the last couple of years, born out of a significant incident that we had about 2 years ago, where the integrity of our classified networks was put in question. That got leaders' attention. And because leaders began to understand the significance of the threat, we began to change the balance in the military between the use of this technology as a convenience and began to understand the significance of it as a operational platform. We are in the middle of changing the way we think about this domain, the way we act on it, acting responsibly and having leaders involved. Once leaders become aware of how significant this is, then the priorities change, and then the resources flow, and real change begins to happen. You can see that evident in the organizational structures and processes that the military is putting in place. I'm living in a command that's real proof of that, and the commitment of the national and the military leadership. But what it has caused is for us within the military to begin to change the balance from the way it used to be to the way it needs to be, and allows us to be flexible in balancing those benefits of the technology along with the risks. In terms of education, I think, you know, beyond the military, this impacts everybody. We're all connected to this. We need, as citizens, we need to understand how we can act responsibly on the internet. Risks that we take, maybe unknowingly as citizens, put many at risk. Because you need to understand what the threats are, and these threats are pervasive throughout our society. This forum is a great opportunity to begin to educate people, to begin to act responsibly on the networks. And then the final challenge is the workforce. None of us have the resources that we need to be able to deal effectively in this. Building the right skill sets, both in the military, in government, and in industry, is a real challenge for the future for us to be more effective.
Let me pick up on the workforce comment. I can't validate these figures, as someone gave me these numbers recently. We graduated something like 9,000 computer science graduates last year, and the Russians graduated 90,000. By contrast, the Chinese, many more than that. We graduated something on the order of 30,000 sports and leisure graduates, for those who manage sports and leisure activities. So is a part of leadership for the nation an educational process that actually produces more technical expertise? Let me go first to Danny.
Yeah, I think this comes to to the point that Bob raised about our ability to even understand what's happening in the internet environment. Both Bob and I have had the pleasure of teaching at MIT at one point or another. What we notice at MIT is that students' interest is moving up the stack, if you will. It's moving up from, say, you know, there are not all that many students who are interested in designing the low-level hardware of the average Ethernet interface or standard components of the network environment. They're interesting technical questions there, obviously, but what we see is more and more students want to understand about the information that's flowing on the network. They want to be able to look at the entire World Wide Web as a system and say, how is this system really functioning? How is the information working? These are challenges that the intelligence community certainly faces. How do you deal with the petabytes of information that, mm-hmm. that flow through the network and make some sense of them, whether it's for the purpose of detecting threats or developing new applications or learning who's interacting with whom? So I think that it is true that we see a decline in computer science majors, as an example, but we see an increase in enrollment in network and computer science related courses, because there are more and more disciplines that depend on that basic knowledge. I come back to the point that we've got to view these more and more as social systems, not just technical systems. So our ability to really understand to retain a leadership role, whether it's in the business environment to figure out what kind of new applications people want, or the military environment to figure out how to actually offer protection at the information level, is going to be based on understanding how true information systems work, not just the bits and the bytes, but the information at the more abstract level. And I think that we're in a period of transition, really. We're seeing the development of new fields. I was involved in the creation of a new interdisciplinary effort called web science. There's been a lot of interest in services science. There's been interest in network science. So I think we will certainly need support from federal research dollars, from private research dollars, to develop this new set of expertise that we need to understand this world that we've created.
So the panel seems to be in agreement that part of our leadership challenge is maintaining informed citizens, educated citizens that can address these issues. But several of you have made reference to understanding what's actually going on the internet. And the question I would pose is, does that mean there's a requirement for instrumentation so that you have a way to know what's going on? And if that's true, what is the government's role in establishing such instrumentation?
We don't have a choice. And I think one of the things that has been an underlying theme is the U.S. has changed, right? And maybe the change is good for economic reasons. People seem to enjoy doing sports management more than... Okay, so that's their choice. But that means we're going to have to deal with being connected to a global network, significant portions of which will be built or managed outside the U.S. It's a very different security challenge. And to deal with that, we're going to think up new strategies that will require a much greater degree of knowledge about what's actually going on these shared networks. So it's inevitable.
This takes us to the key question. Is our current governance model sufficient, or must it evolve in some way? So I'm going to frame it as, is it sufficient? And if not, how must it change over the next 10 years? Greg?
So perspective. I do not think it's sufficient. I think from a U.S. perspective, it is going in the right direction. I think some of the things that the U.S. has done, you know, ICANN, but other sorts of multi-stakeholder organizations, saying that the governance of cyberspace or the internet is a global proposition, are the right models. Much of cyberspace is ungoverned, right? So as Bob said, there gets to be a lot of attention on ICANN, but who governs the routing space, right? So maybe the domain name space at least has a construct. No one governs the routing space, which is arguably much more important. And Mike, it gets a little bit to your instrumentation question. Mm-hmm. My perspective would be we need to assess where the internet is ill-governed, but more importantly, non-governed, create the right institutions, which shouldn't be solely governmental, need to include certainly the private sector, but a full range of stakeholders. And then instead of, I think it's risky and probably incorrect in my mind for governments to instrument the internet, hold those governance organizations accountable for the measurements that you need, right? You know, is there too much phishing that transits websites, right? There are people that you could make responsible for providing those measurements, because I do think, to Bob's point, we need some sort of sense of how healthy the ecosystem is and measurement, but I wouldn't get governments in the instrumentation role. I get governments in the governance role and demanding certain metrics that they expect of those who govern the internet.
Danny, then we'll come to Dr. Khan.
Yeah, this question of instrumentation, I think, brings us to one of the really critical social and policy challenges where I think the U.S. has to lead globally. We are in an increasingly transparent environment as citizens, by transparent I mean exposed, not see-through. You asked about the critical changes over the next 10 years. I would suggest that the dominant change that we're going to face is that every individual's life all around the world is going to be increasingly documented, captured, represented, and stored in this internet environment. Everyone. That even people who we don't even think of as being online. This goes all the way down to the kid who lives in a village in Africa who gets on a cell phone and gets on the mobile web every once in a while. We have extraordinary visibility into the activity of individual activity that we have never ever had before, and we have the ability, all of us, the private sector, the government sector, the military, have the ability to look at that data, to use it. So I think that there's a big governance question about how we manage this instrumentation, but I would say that's going to happen. The fact of instrumentation is a done deal. It's an unstoppable force because there are so many compelling reasons to do it, and what in individual cases, and together we get an incredibly transparent environment, and that data that we collect, as you said earlier, Mike, has incredible value to governments, to law enforcement, to the military, to the private sector, to individuals. I think that the key U.S. leadership challenge globally is to help frame a governance environment for that information so that people feel confident that it's being used for the purposes it ought to be used for, that they have a way to detect when it's being misused, and that when necessary, those who we entrust our security with have access to it so that they can do their job of protecting us. But this is the key challenge where I think the U.S. is uniquely positioned with a number of our allies to lead.
It's interesting. You're our expert on privacy, and for the panel, and as we develop the discussion here, we find ourselves talking about instrumentation, which you're reinforcing. And I expected you to pick up the privacy side, so now I'm going to go to Jim Lewis, who's looked at it from policy perspective. Given that there's instrumentation, as we've discussed, or it may evolve that way, how do you think about the privacy issues?
The part that I wonder about is that the technology's changing. We're moving. I hate to do it, and we ought to have a $5 fine for every time you use the word cloud, so I'll pay you after the show. We're moving into the cloud, and that means that the little device that you carry is not going to be the PC, the hobbyist PC that you run Windows on and stores your data. That'll all be done somewhere else. And that means the focus of attention has to move away from the edge for some of these big policy issues. One of the questions I have, I'll get to privacy, is, you know, one benefit sometimes from a defensive perspective is to look for choke points where your opponents are going to congregate. And one of the questions we have to wrestle with is the tier one service providers. And a lot of traffic, particularly international traffic, is aggregated in a few places. Mm-hmm. And at that point, it becomes a little more manageable to think about this problem. And that means you might want to think then about what are the policies for those big network operators. They're going to get all this data. What are they going to do with it? Are they going to exploit it for commercial purposes? And in that place, I think the U.S. is, again, the thing I found in talking to other countries is we're not always on the same wavelength as they are. Mm-hmm. The Europeans, we all know, are much more sensitive about privacy. The Chinese talk about privacy. I don't think they really care. I'm not sure the Brazilians and the Russians understand it either. So someone has to come up with a better construct than the one we have now, either U.S. or European, that will let us deal with the problem as we move towards managed services.
What we've evolved here is a discussion of instrumentation, potential for the cloud, and I'll pay my $5. I want to ask the key technical question of Dr. Khan, since he started this mess with TCP/IP years ago. If we evolve to the cloud, if computing becomes a utility, does that allow us then technically to achieve a higher level of protection with an increased level of privacy protection for our citizens?
Actually, I think those two questions are almost independent of one another. I believe that whether we get more protection or not, more privacy or not, really depends on what's going on in the details. I was going to make one comment on the instrumentation question to the extent that if you don't have a good model of what you're instrumenting, the data may not be very useful. And I think we've got a really bad understanding of the internet today and almost no model of it. So if you were a physicist and trying to instrument what's going on and somebody says, I'm going to tell you where every particle is at every moment of time, what it's bounced against, you may be able to use that for no good purpose. But if you had a model of pressure and temperature, that might be more useful. And the second comment I was going to make is that on the governance front, I think that it's something that we need to understand that there are aspects about the internet today, or cyberspace more generally, that really defy the general governance question. If you were to look at the world economy and ask, what's our governance model for it? What you could identify are things that individual countries do to oversee commerce in their country, to regulate it perhaps, but much of what takes place is through the protocols of business, as you will. Who's buying what, who's selling what, who's deciding to offer what. You know, in some places it's more centrally planned, in other cases it's not. I think the same kind of thinking applies to the internet today, and governance is probably not a term I would have chosen to use. I know it's in the parlance right now, but I think it's going to have to be teased into the components that various countries can do, and the rest is going to be what the participants in the internet do on their own.
Would the panel like to entertain the question of, given that there are coordination issues across the federal government interagency context, is there a place where that coordination should be led in the U.S. government?
That's a really good one, and I go back and forth on it. As a nation, we prefer a really disorganized approach generally, and that's been our tradition. So maybe we should just accept it. Every time we've created a big new single department, DOD, Energy, Homeland Security, it's always been a big mess, takes years to sort out. Sometimes it never gets sorted out. So you could counter that by saying, we'll look at USTR, small agency, relatively nimble, clearly defined mission. Maybe we need to do that. And I think that's one of the big issues in front of us is, do we like the traditional, you know, herd approach, or do we want to move to something like a USTR model?
Trade representative.
Right.
Denny.
I'm new in government. I don't have anywhere near the experience of you or many on the panel. I think that one of the things the U.S. government needs to learn is the decentralized governance structure that actually makes the internet work. There are so many parts of the executive branch alone, forget about the other branches, there's so many parts of the executive branch that have their finger in some part of the internet environment. And I think that the challenge is really much more of trying to develop common themes, synergistic approaches. There's not going to be a single office of internet policy, as much as I might like to run it. There's not going to be that anywhere because it wouldn't be appropriate. It would be as if we said, well, we should have an office of air use. We don't do that. Every government agency needs to breathe the air, and we don't make them all go through one office to get permission about how many breaths a minute to take. But we certainly want to make sure that our air is kept with, you know, good quality, and that people don't use it the wrong way. And we try to coordinate these things. But we've got to recognize the incredible breadth of interest in the internet environment. And I think, I think this White House, by putting attention on the cybersecurity issues, on the internet innovation issues, has really, and on some of the social innovation issues associated with the internet, I think has really started to chart out a path by which all these different efforts across the government can start to move in common directions.
Let me just jump on that one real quick, though, because there's a crucial point, and I think it's one of the things that dogs our internet policy in this country, and that is that in business and in society, there are clear incentives, there are institutions. You know, it's money, it's markets, it's social things. That doesn't work in politics. So, yeah, decentralized approach might be good, but to say that we can sit back and let it emerge naturally the way we do with a lot of economic and social things, that isn't going to work. So we need to come up with some new way to think about this, and we're very far from that. But right.
So a model I have in mind, I don't know that it's the answer, is I do think the policy issue is certainly the operational aspect of dealing with challenges in cyberspace is much more like a soccer game than it is a football game, right? So I'm going to go to, you know, and Jim's showing his skepticism, but I don't think a single quarterback is
it's
the
not
answer.
One of those 5-year-old kids. It's not.
That's what I was thinking.
No, but a well played. So I'll build on that, right? So it's not a football game where there's discrete plays. The action's moving. You've got to keep the ball in play and moving in the direction you want all the time. The dysfunction of a kid's soccer game is everybody goes to the ball, right? And we've seen a lot of that in terms of how we dealt with at least the national security aspects of, you know, cybersecurity challenges, I'd argue, in the last decade. And people want a quarterback to put everybody on a line. My sense is a good soccer team, the defense has leaders. When the ball enters that zone, that they know where the key players are on the field and what to do to get it onto the other side of the field. And when they need to strike, they get the ball to the right striker. So there's no quarterback in the sense that there's one offense. but the team as a whole knows how to play together, knows what the right leader is in the right situation, and how to get the ball from one zone to another as appropriate. So that's not an answer in terms of, you know, who's who, but it's more to the decentralized and knowing who needs to act in the right situation than it is to, you know, a national office of cyber policy.
Being the oldest member of the panel, I would admit a couple of things. One, I still use the yellow tablet. And two, I played football and I don't understand soccer, so it's a little bit of a challenge for me. This is the last question, and I'd like to get each of our panel members to comment. I think we all agreed as people serving the nation that public safety is a responsibility of the government, and security of the nation is a responsibility of the government. One of the things that we passed over with regard to what rides in the internet is with regard to the value of the data and how dependent we are upon that data for transactions and commerce and movement of goods and services and so on. The question I would like to ask is, when you recognize the value of that data in terms of money supply or electric power, how do we balance as a government the public safety issues with this sort of innovative spirit? How does that get balanced? And I take you back to this digital idea of a digital age, Madison, Jefferson, and Hamilton, and Adams, with regard to this balance. So, last comment, how do we do that as a nation? Where we are, looking at the threats and the opportunities out over the next 10 years. Hard question. Who would like to go first? Danny.
To make sure that the internet is going to be secure and innovative, what we do is we build on our strengths. We recognize that we've managed to build an extraordinarily secure financial environment, for example, in the internet and cyberspace overall. We have other critical infrastructure areas in which we've really got very good attention to security. And then we have other arenas in which the risks are lower and we allow things to be much more open. That makes them cheaper, makes them more flexible, and it allows innovation to happen more quickly. So I think as we've moved down this road of recognizing that there's a broad set of risks, what we've actually done is to look at them risk by risk, area by area, and made sure that the parties who can control, who can take steps to make an environment secure, have an incentive to do that, have the resources to do that, that the government provides whatever assistance is necessary to keep those efforts aligned. But we recognize that the internet is an absolutely general purpose infrastructure. We use it for everything from voting to education to conducting military operations. And we've got to allow that diversity and heterogeneity to continue and make sure that those who are responsible step up and take responsibility in their areas.
Others? Dr. Khan?
Well, I believe if the focus is really on the information, then what we need to do in the future is move toward a structuring of the internet so that we're dealing with the data structures themselves. Historically, we dealt with the wires, we dealt with the machines, we dealt with the files on those machines, we thought about securing the wires, but I think we can deal with the data itself, we can access the data itself, we can access...
Secure the data.
We can secure the data as separate objects in their own right, we can access pieces of it, and we have a different notion of how to go about managing security at the information level rather than trying to manage the pieces that provide the infrastructure that allow us to create and access the information.
Interesting thought from the co-inventor of the current process. Others?
My impression is that our approach to internet security right now is roughly parallel to our approach to mortgage banking, which is to say it's pretty messed up, right? And it's going to take us a long time as a country to figure out how to fix that. And there has to be some balance. The market's not going to do this by itself. The private sector will not deliver security. That's why we don't have private armies or private police forces. And when we do have those places, they don't work very well. At the same time, you don't want, you know, the European Union with heavy-handed regulation and squashing innovation. So how do we find that middle ground? And the answer is we're just going to stumble from kind of like a pinball machine from side to side until we get there. And that will take us a long time. But I think that we're inhibited in some ways by this inability to perceive the internet as it really works, and the inability to realize that the rest of the world may come to a different solution set if we don't engage with them.
Interesting thought. Two last comments. Greg?
I guess the one thing that I would avoid is the notion that there's one answer or one solution, right? Mm-hmm. You know, while Jim's saying you're kind of pinballing back and forth, I think one way to look at it, that's agility, and that's the American strength, is to be able to change direction quickly in an environment that's changing all the time. So, you know, again, I think my comments tend to be that there's not necessarily an answer that you have to move to over a decade-long period. It's being able to adjust most nimbly to the forces, you know, as they confront us.
Well, in our context of never giving the military a position where they're not subject to civilian control, we're going to give the military the last word. So, General.
Well, yes, sir. The from a military perspective, I think something might be useful in this issue of balancing. At Cyber Command, we tend to want to address the global issues for the military, and in a decentralized manner, we want to empower all those other organizations to take action at their level. That enables us to adjust the balance between acting in unison and acting in a decentralized manner very quickly. The key to that for us is building the situational awareness mm-hmm. and early warning that enables that, so everyone's looking at the same picture. I think we're making progress inside the military. The challenge is we're reliant on all those interdependencies outside of our military networks. Mm-hmm. So being able to see what's happening on a global scale outside the military is the only way we're going to be able to posture ourselves effectively inside of our networks to be able to respond to threats rapidly. We got a long way to go with regard to that. And it's not just, you know, today our responsibility is to protect our military networks only. We think we also need to be prepared to help outside of that arena, and we're just on the beginning edge of achieving the types of connections and relationships with other organizations broadly to be able to do that.
So I think if I summarize some of the things I heard today, we agreed that it is a responsibility of the government to worry about the safety and security of our citizens. There's some level of instrumentation of this net, internet, cyberspace that we see. However it evolves, it will evolve because it's a requirement. And the need for the United States to maintain its leadership role is to lead. And that can be in education, it could be in international forums and so on, but it says it's very important for our future and we must pay attention. I'd like to thank this distinguished panel for your contributions today. It was a fascinating discussion. Today's Export Voices panel, our subject was Cyber 2020, the future of the internet, and it featured immediately to my left Brigadier General John Davis, who is the Director of Current Operations at Cyber Command, Dr. Bob Kahn, Chairman and CEO of the Corporation for National Research Initiatives, also the co-inventor with Vint Cerf of the Internet TCP/IP protocols that started us down this path. Dr. James Lewis, who is the author of the principal document for recommending to the current president how he should think about and address this issue. He's, of course, with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Retired Colonel Greg Rattray, who served in the White House, is currently a partner with Delta Risk. And Daniel Weitzner, who is the Associate Administrator for the Office of Policy Analysis in the National Telecommunications and Information Association, NTIA, of the Department of Commerce. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your contributions. This Expert Voices panel was brought to you by Booz Allen and Hamilton and the Federal News Radio. I encourage you to listen to this panel on demand, watch the video from the panel, and read the expert commentary on this topic at boozallen.com/expertvoices. This is Mike McConnell, Executive Vice President at Booz Allen Hamilton. We thank you very much for listening.